Let us join in prayer. Our loving Heavenly Father, grant us the grace to accept the Lordship of Christ and the leadership of the Holy Spirit in our daily lives. Amen. You can't trust anyone under 54. The profound wisdom of this incisive judgment has dawned upon me in new and fresh and meaning on this, the eve of my 54th birthday. Now, why have I come to this conviction? And what have been the experiences that have confirmed me in this particular prejudice? Through the generous cooperation of the Southeastern Baptist Seminary community and a liberal fellowship at Hebrew Union College Biblical and Archaeological School in Jerusalem, Israel, I spent the 15 months beginning June 1968 living, working, and traveling in the Middle East and some of the communist countries of Eastern Europe and in most of the free democratic countries of Western Europe. During these 15 and a half months, and from all of these different vantage points, I tried to keep my eyes on my native land and I hope on the world. Now, what did I see? I saw many, many things. Some of them were obvious and conspicuous things. Others of them were very subtle. Let me speak to you today about just one of the very obvious things and then perhaps draw some subtle implications from it. Everywhere, less true in the communist countries of Eastern Europe than other places, I saw multitudes of young Americans. In most cases, though there were some few exceptions, and I'll mention them in a moment, these were the unwashed, the unshaven, the unshorn, the uncombed, the uninvolved, beatniks, hippies, zippies, yippies, and other ne'er-do-wells. And among them were the cop-outs, the thrown-outs, the down-and-outs, the fouled-outs, the way-outs, the hard-up, the hung-up, the tossed-up, the knocked-up, the uncommitted, the radically committed to nothing, the ought-to-be-committed, the new left, the far left, the done been left, the got nothing left, the draft dodger, the work dodger, the responsibility dodger, the mama and the papa dodger, the law dodger, and all kinds of other people. What do they do? I ask a businessman on the Dom in Amsterdam, where a typical colony of these young people spend their nights and days. Oh, he said, they don't do anything. They just sit there. I thought he was talking about a Baptist church. But how about food and lodging? I said to him. Oh, well, one will get a check from home, or another one will present a card to passers-by on which is written a request for 50 Dutch cents to buy a sandwich, which they always share, he said. And they also sleep there on the war memorial. Then later, one of them could be seen at the doorway of a fashionable store playing a very discordant tune on a recorder or a five-note shepherd's pipe with his beggar's cup on the pavement beside him, or two of them could be heard hitting an occasional harmonious note as they sang to the accompaniment of an amateurishly played guitar while pennies were tossed by shoppers into an old felt hat nearby. Further investigation revealed that these large groups of young people in Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Rome, Paris, and the other big cities of Western Europe were not all Americans. About 30% of them are Germans, Norwegians, Swedes, Danes, and other Western Europeans, but almost without exception, they are from the affluent free countries of the West, the democracies. Now, there's also the young expatriate, he's the other fellow I was going to mention, temporary or permanent, who is not a true beatnik. He pays his way, at least somebody does, for he has enough money to be on the move. With his long hair, his lamb chop sideburns, and his ever-present girlfriend hanging on his arm, he's seen every place. He too is said to be a radical, And as a matter of fact, in one group of 21 of these whom I met and with whom I talked, 18 of them bragged about having been thrown out of their various universities for troublemaking of one kind or another. One learns a great deal from talking with these disaffected young. And one thing, however, stands out above everything else in their litany of lost values and dead dreams. And I quote them, "America is morally and spiritually bankrupt." "But that's a generalization," I protested. "Be more articulate." This was probably my second mistake, the first one having been to try to talk to them anyway, that is to understand them. For all at once, like a great chorus, they began to shout, one louder than the other, "How about the war in Vietnam? How about the race problem all over the world, especially in America? How about the growing wave of anti-Semitism in the world, especially in America? How about the inequities in the tax laws, the loopholes that Congress refuses to plug for which the poor must pay the bill? How about congressmen themselves? How can a Republican senator from Oklahoma demand as a price for his support of the missile program that a gifted, dedicated young lawyer be fired just because he's a Democrat? Or what's ethical about letting the American Medical Association or the CIO, the National Association of Manufacturers, dictate congressional action? And dozens of other pressure groups that lobby for special treatment and get it sometimes from Congress at the expense of the common welfare were named to me by these protesting young people. Another one yelled, "But why all the yelling about law and order in the streets when big organized front office crime goes untouched because it can make the payoff?" And then another one says, "Why can't we have free love openly and honestly without being hypocritical? Everybody does it anyhow on the sly." "And yes," said a young woman, "we're going to teach Hortense free love." And she was speaking about her five-day-old daughter, and her husband and father of the child, I presume, smiled and nodded approvingly. "And how about the ridiculous drug laws? We're hurting only ourselves if drugs are harmful." Well, from every side, they challenged me and continued to document their claim that America is morally and spiritually bankrupt. And of course, I was reeling and am still reeling from this encounter just a few weeks ago, the final one. But I tried a feeble comeback, and I said to them, "What are your future plans? What are you going to do when it rains?" I said, "We'll go in that arcade." "But how about your long-term plans? What do you hope to do with your lives?" Well, there were all kinds of answers, but by far the most common answer was, "We don't know. We never have thought it through." But I said, "But you're all radicals. At least you call yourselves radicals. You're either radical activists or you're radical non-radicals. And your favorite words are commitment and relevance. Everything else you've tried has failed. You've admitted that, so much so that you have copped out." And I guess to translate that word for the over 30 generation, that means they've resigned from the human race. To put it in the simplest language, this is their understanding. They just resign from any human relationships that require or demand anything. They're just like mice. And in terms of their animal presences now, I'm not talking about the deeper person in any given case. But I say, "You've copped out. Have you ever considered deeply and seriously a radical commitment to the gospel of Jesus Christ?" "Hell," they said, "do you think that's relevant? Look what happened to him. Look what happened to Gandhi. Look what happened to Martin Luther King." Well, I think they played into my hands at this point, for my answer to them was, "But look what happens to everybody." Is the basic question really what we die for or what we live for? Even the most hardy of us live but a short while, and then we die. I thought a great deal in recent days about my encounters with these disillusioned young Americans, and I've asked myself, I guess, 100 times, what would I do if I were one of them, or even if I were one of you? If I could start my life anew today with the great wisdom, I might add, that 54 years have given me, I would ask myself three very simple questions. First, what are the options, really? Second, what are the things that demand to be changed? And are there any things worth conserving? Admittedly, these are big questions, and I'm only just going to touch them. In considering the options, I would ask myself about the future of the human race itself. If it may not be here long unless some of you begin to deal redemptively with the great sin of the race, the pollution of the three valuable natural resources, water, land, and air. The trip to the moon and other space ambitions are but the deep, instinctive drive of the race for self-preservation. Deep down in his psyche, perhaps as altogether as unconsciously as a pine tree desperately adds seed burrs the year before its demise, man is striving to gain other planets because he knows this one's been doomed by folly. Now, I think man will gain other planets, and I don't have any doubt about it. I think he will live on them. In fact, some of you will remember one of my foolish prophecies some few years ago, ways will be found to move from one planet to another with the speed of light, perhaps on laser beams. Some such thing as this will take place, I think. Some kind of a deconstitution chamber where one can enter, be transformed into a beam or a unit of energy, be transported great distances, and reconstituted without harm and without more than a momentary loss of memory. Now, even more fantastic, though, now that biological research has synthesized life, though it does falter temporarily at the metabolic level, laboratory-produced beings may soon be put out on some of the planets adapted in the laboratory to the peculiar and particular conditions of the planets on which they're going to live. Soon, to use the words of Dr. Vannevar Bush, some very simple short-chain nucleic acid synthesized from inert matter and placed in a chemical soup will suddenly assemble accurate images of itself. Now, what kind of being are you going to fashion when it's your turn to synthesize the soup? Still further, if the Earth is really just a speck of dust in a great cosmic dust storm, and I frankly think that's just what it is, consider the possibility that man may indeed be on the way out of the whole picture. Walter Sullivan, 5 years ago in his book, We're Not Alone, said, not only are we not central in the scheme of things, but we may be inferior physically, mentally, and spiritually to more highly evolved beings elsewhere. Now, there is a distinct possibility that we may wipe ourselves out, either by nuclear war or less mercifully by the gradual pollution of our environment, before we evolve to the stage of these higher beings. But does it follow at all that since we are not alone and maybe inferior, that we are not important or that we have no value at all? I think indeed not. God certainly cares about our neighbors in the universe, and he cares about us. As Rabbi Abraham Besdin says, one's cosmic address may impress snobs, but not those who value integrity and intrinsic worth. If man on earth has shown himself capable of reaching God, and if God has responded in a reciprocal gesture of concern, then a relationship of transcendental dimensions has been achieved. God does not mingle solely with the well-situated. Now, is it not anthropomorphistic to suggest that God's capacity of awareness is limited or is influenced by one's social status in the constellar hierarchy? Young friends, God cares about every single one of us. That is certainly an important option, and I wish I had time to talk about others, but life or death of the human race is an option that's deserving of the best you can give it, and you can't help if you cop out. Now, what are some of the things that need changing? Again, the shouts of my young friends din my ears, and I agree with them that war is hell, and they weren't the first to invent the idea, and it's evil. And I think we need a world without war, but I remind you that wars are made by men, and they must be unmade by men. Racial strife is worldwide. It is certainly widespread here in America. Here and elsewhere in the world, racial minorities that cannot shape up are treated as nuisances. Now, why, for example, should Negro Americans have to riot and protest for rights and privileges that the rest of us take for granted? Prejudice and the ignorance which breeds it are man-made. They, too, must be unmade by men, by you men. If every minister in every pulpit would take a firm stand in Christian love against any and every kind of racism, and if every Christian would resolve with God's help to love his neighbor as himself, then no longer could hatreds divide us and separate us. Antisemitism again threatens the world Jewish community. This time, the announced aim of its most vocal supporters is to wipe out forever any semblance of a Jewish national identity. Now, is your generation going to repeat the cowardly folly of which mine is guilty and permit the massacre of millions again just because they're Jews? This is a problem worthy of your deepest concern and of your greatest abilities to resolve it. The tax law inequities and other lapses in government integrity do need changing, and they will be corrected when men of unimpeachable character run regularly for elective office and when all good men take seriously the responsibility to vote. When all men and all women of honor demand it, labor, management, business, organized religion, self-interest groups of all kinds will yield to and serve the common good. Organized crime can exist only in a climate of greed and lust. Good men can have good government, but they must work for it. And they can have good communities, but they've got to make them. One cannot contribute to the building and creating of anything that's redemptive and lasting by copping out. I don't want to get involved is as American anymore as apple pie. Now, there are, of course, many other things that need changing in the world, but none of them will change themselves. It is necessary for all good men to become actively involved, and we solve nothing by resigning from the human race. Now to a final question. Is there anything worth conserving? And my answer to this question is a strong affirmative. I would keep the church, but I want it to be understood that I think the church too must undergo radical, agonizingly deep change. But let me quote my disaffected friends again, this time about the church, and this is the gentlest quote I have in my whole collection of quotes. It's in a hell of a mess. Most of them wouldn't even discuss it. You know what they say to me? They say, oh, get with it, man, which in their language means you're talking about nothing. Talk about something. Well, I would certainly change it, but I would not throw the church out completely, as many of them and some other people suggest. Before one goes that far, I think he ought to contemplate or try to contemplate a churchless society. Let me turn aside from this question a moment and make two comparisons. What, for example, will you substitute for the university or the seminary if it is finally taken over and destroyed in the current student power struggle? Don't make the mistake of dismissing that possibility with some such glib, backhanded judgment as, oh, never mind, that won't happen, won't be destroyed. Vermont Royster says, campus disorders reflect a basic failure of higher education to account for an intangible need of Americans. That need? A sense of meaning in life. The question of how man should conduct himself, what his goals in life should be, how he should measure success are no longer academic questions. Men have for centuries been seeking the answers to these questions. Is the tendency of the young to reject traditional values as meaningless a form of the search for these answers? Are the young forging what amounts to a new religion? Maybe the consciously irrational and destructive protest activities of many of the young are not attempts to achieve some feasible political end so much as they are efforts to purge and to purify, to make a clean break with the rational system of institutions devoted to the pursuit of financial security, which system is corrupt and sinful. That sentence is a quotation from Paul Goodman. Goodman also says that the new religion of the young is not based on intellectual competence or spiritual courage, but rather on glibness and unreality. This is an inadequate response to the important question of meaning and results from a lack of perspective. That's why I said you can't trust anybody under 54. Society's institutions do have their failings, but with what will you young replace them? Now the second comparison, what should we put in place of government when finally the black flag of anarchy waves on high? There's much truth in the charge of the disaffected under 30 generation that America is morally and spiritually bankrupt, but is the alternative anarchy? Theodore H. White, the author of the great series Making of the President, says there's current today what he calls a new intolerance, in which the United States government is the master of all evil and the chief agent of world repression. The establishment is as corrupt as the Romanov dynasty, and the spokesmen of the new intolerance are infused with a morality so stark that any deviation from their morality is heresy, and any difference of opinion is villainy. This new avant-garde has come to despise its own country and its traditions. Now what shall we use to fill the void? In a book entitled The Making of a Counterculture, Theodore Roszak says that the new generation would substitute a new culture in which the non-intellective capacities of the personality, those capacities that take fire from visionary splendor and the experience of human communion, become the arbiters of the good and the true and the beautiful. Now, this has come about, in Roszak's judgment, because the American technocratic society has made it possible for the younger generation to be raised according to the permissive doctrines of Dr. Spock and remain in school, irresponsible and pampered sometimes for 20 years. Thus, the young are influenced to believe that being human has to do with pleasure and freedom. Economic security is something they can take for granted, the result being that after graduation, many of the young refuse to surrender their independence and their desire for sensual gratification to the repressive efficiency demands of the corporation and the government. Now, where do we go from there? That's my question. To a festival in a pasture field where we can sit naked in the mud puddle with hundreds or even thousands of other persons like ourselves smoking pot and taking trips on speed? Is it really necessary to sit naked in the mud and contemplate one's navel in order to know one's identity? Are narcotics really mind expanders? Do myriad decibels of amplified noise really put meaning into life? Does a disregard of traditional morality really make one a human being? Is it enough only to be human? Does all else that's good follow from that? Even the intelligentsia of the disaffected young have their doubts. Why else would they dabble in astrology and witchcraft, psychedelic dreams, and whatever else is despised by science? Being human is very important, but it is more than just the warmth of assembled bodies, to use Kafka's figure, and he was talking about mice, by the way. Life has meaning, but human relationships are more than just two warm bodies in close proximity. When we know ourselves and each other, we realize that there is much more to knowledge than simply the sociology of knowledge. Now back to the more serious question. I say I'm going to leave it for you to answer. What would you put in place of the church when it's gone? I repudiate Luther. God has not turned his face away. Things do have meaning. I am not estranged in this world. Now, just as there is more to knowledge than a sociology of knowledge, there is infinitely more to religion than a sociology or even a philosophy of religion. Now, young gentlemen and young ladies, my admonition is don't cop out. Don't throw in the towel. This is no more and no less than running to the shelter for protection against the philosophical fallout of our times. Don't give up in despair. That would be simply to admit that you're not capable of the thinking that now demands to be done. Every age has had its crises. And the twitches and convulsions of your day are not the last nervous movements of a dying world. They are the first life stirrings of a whole new world that wants to be born. Man's extraterrestrial ambitions, the cop-out psychology of many young people, the distress cries of the Negroes and other minority groups, the upward reach of the underdeveloped, newly emerging nations, These are all parts of the same phenomenon. In the very nature of the universe, there is what I would call the God self. In spite of himself, man reaches out for that God self. Now, whatever we do that obstructs man from this fulfillment, and certainly we do many things, some of them well-intentioned and some of them very piously named, but whatever we do really finally to obstruct man from the realization of this God self is itself sin against man and against God, who is himself creator, sustainer, and redeemer. No, my friends, especially my young friends, whatever you may think to the contrary, the day of great challenges is not over, and the God of great causes is not dead. Your life can mean more than any man's before you, so don't cop out. Give us creative, redemptive alternatives to the nihilism you think you've inherited. Let us stand for prayer. Grant us the grace, dear God, today to love every man and woman in the world and to be so concerned for the dominion with which we are charged over that world and the opportunities presented to us in that world that we shall measure up, not in our own strength, because we indeed are in earthen vessels, but by thy grace, that we shall measure up to the high standard of the gospel seen in Jesus the Christ, in whose name we pray.